Okay, this is sound roll number 47. For Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Production, we have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Here comes tone. Okay, we're now continuing on camera roll. Camera roll 97. We're starting the interview with Jerry Cohen. We're starting with take number one. And it's still the 30th of August.
This is take one, Jerry Cohen, marker.
We've got a lot to cover, Jerry, but let's start with a crucial period, talking about how the law, the ALRA, came into being. There'd been talk about going for a legal solution for a long time. What was it that actually made that a real idea in 74 and 75?
The law became real as soon as we lost the grape contracts in 73. When we asked the growers for an election in 73, they told us to go to hell. And the Teamsters were negotiating, and they signed, you know, the love affair between the growers and the Teamsters is a continuing one. And they signed their sweetheart contract in 73, and I remember taking a long ride with Caesar in the Coachella Valley and basically said, you know, at this point, we've got no choice, because we'd been resisting a law. And so we decided in 73 that we'd go for a law, and the reality of the strike in 73, that whole struggle, created the pressure on various interest groups, which allowed us to get that law in 75.
Well, when you say Caesar and we in general had been resisting the law, why would you not try for a law? Because what were you going
to
lose?
See, our friends, we didn't like to be told what to do. And our friends in Washington used to pontificate and lecture to us. And the AFL told us that what we really needed was the National Labor Relations Act. But under the National Labor Relations Act, unions could not secondary boycott. And if you want me to back up a little bit, I can tell you how the power of the secondary boycott came about, because it's related to where we end up. Mm-hmm. When I first came to the union, one of the first things Caesar had me do was get in the car, and we drove up to see a labor lawyer who was volunteering his time. It was during the Pearlie Minetti fight. And there were in that lawyer's files boxes and boxes of injunctions, and they'd stipulated to injunctions under the NLRB, which made the secondary boycott illegal. In other words, the union would boycott a store where Pearlie Minetti wine was being sold, and then these lawyers would stipulate that they couldn't secondary boycott with the NLRB. And the question that had to come to people's minds is, why in the hell should farm workers be inhibited by a law which gave them no rights? And the reason was because we had 9 people at DiGiorgio in a peanut shed that were commercial workers. So if you have anybody that's covered by the law, the whole union's covered by the law. So all the other workers had no rights. Those 9 guys did, and the union couldn't boycott. So what we decided to do was set up a separate union, which we did was called the United Peanut Shelling Workers of America. And there were 9 guys in it. And the joke was, since we're the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, first you flock and then you pshwa. I don't assume that'll get on TV. But anyhow, we set this union up. Erwin DeShettler was its president. We got them out, and we started a secondary boycott. This made a lot of people in labor uneasy, because what it meant was a lot of real people from the fields in front of stores asking customers not to shop at Safeway, and retail clerks, meat cutters, and other people in the stores didn't really like that. So the AFL was putting heat on us. And what they were saying was, it's realistic to have the National Labor Relations Act, but we'd have lost the power to secondary boycott. So for that reason, we resisted the law.
But when you get to 74 and 75, do you want to have your cake and eat it? You want to be able to have elections and still be able to boycott if you want to?
Yes. We were fairly cocky. Remember, when the farm workers, you know, when they're really moving, it's like water running downhill. We felt like even if the Teamsters had the contract, we had the people. And I think the fact that 3,500 people went to jail in 73 proves the fact that we did have the people. And what we decided to do was draft a law while Reagan was still governor that just simply gave us the right to elections. And the gamble we were taking, with no unfair labor practices, and the gamble we were taking was that the Teamsters would be afraid of elections, and we knew they controlled the Senate, they'd kill it in the Senate. So in 74, we went through a period of first drafting the law, which we wanted to create 2 main principles: an industrial unit where all the workers were in one unit, because we figured if there were craft units, that would be like mandating what we called legislative ghettos in the field. So that the field workers couldn't be on the trucks, they couldn't be on the tractors, okay? So we decided we'll just draft a simple election law, and we'll get 2 principles established: quick elections, because under the National Labor Relations Act, elections sometimes don't come till the next year. So we demanded elections in 7 days at peak season, so most of the workers got to vote, because we felt confident that if the pickers were out there, we'd win the elections, not the Teamsters. And we wanted an industrial unit. And we got that through the assembly in 74.
Stop. Convention.
Yeah.
That's a 10-minute point there.
All right.
Okay, that's the end of Camera Roll 97, and that's take one.
Bill?
Yeah, that's aleatory.
Camera Roll 98, and take two.
Now L.A. City Councilman.
That's
speeding. And rolling.
Okay, Jerry Cohn, take two. Marker.
Okay, so in a way, the aleatory bill was the dry run at it, but let's talk about when it really happens, when Brown is elected, when the growers are willing to come to the table and are not going to block it. Talk about how that negotiation works and the dynamic, what you had to do to make it happen.
Well, first we had to get Brown's attention. And there's a history here, because even in 74, when Brown was running for governor, Leo McCarthy, as Speaker of the Assembly, said we need Brown's help. And Brown wouldn't take our calls until we threatened to picket him. We sent some people over there. I was running the negotiations in Sacramento when Brown didn't take the call. Some farm workers went to measure his offices. Then Brown got the message, and he calls. Well, after he becomes governor, there was silence. We didn't hear from our friend Jerry. This is a guy who used to come around and profess interest in what we were doing. And what got his attention was the March on Gallo. In March of 1975, there were 20,000 people that marched to Modesto. And Gallo, smart as they are, said, take your problem to Sacramento. Well, that march caught Jerry Brown's attention. And a call came in, maybe a day or two later, which led to a meeting at Brown's house in, I think it's in near Echo Park, in, I don't know where it is, it's in LA. Anyhow, Brown, Rose Byrd, a professor named Herman Levy, Leroy Chatfield, Jacques Barzaghi, and Caesar, and I went to meet. And Brown said that he was ready to listen to the discussions on a farm labor law. And he had had Rose Byrd, his Secretary of Agriculture, draft a law, which we didn't much like, didn't have, it inhibited our right to boycott, didn't have quick elections.
Well, did that mean he was ready to let you draft the law, though?
No, it meant that he was ready to listen to our concerns. And our position was that we'd rather have no law than a law that doesn't work. And we had a lot of issues that we wanted taken care of. Industrial unit, quick elections, we wanted the right to secondary boycott. We wanted access to the fields. We wanted lists. We wanted all the rights other unions had. Plus, we thought we needed a little bit more because farm workers, after all, were voiceless and powerless. And that led to Brown introducing a law which fell far short of our expectations. At that point, what we decided to do was attack him. And I had a press conference in Sacramento, and I attacked the law. Caesar started going around to junior colleges and saying that Brown really didn't know a potato from a tomato. And it wasn't a question of whether he could spell it, it's a question of whether he even knew it. So that led to some negotiations which culminated, I think, in the first weekend of May in Brown's office. They were weekend negotiations all night. I had met with Brown in his apartment before that, and I had a list.
Well, but let me jump in here.
Yeah.
I mean, here's a guy who's sympathetic to the farm workers, who hires one of Caesar's chief aides as his chief of staff. Was this a public show? Was this what you call a dog and pony act? I mean, did he say, you've got to turn the screws on so it looks like there's pressure here and then I can respond?
Well, see, the beauty of it was that it was more ambiguous and ambivalent than that, because they didn't know how serious we were about a law. They were being told by people like Jim Lorenz that some of us were nuts and really didn't want a law. So Brown was off guard, and frankly, our posture always was the crazier they think we are, the better, because you can negotiate more. And our posture was really, if we don't get what we need, we just as soon stay in the law of the jungle, because we hewed out those machetes pretty well and knew how to hack our way through that jungle. So it's a combination. He was sympathetic at some point, but he's a politician, and he wanted to get away as cheaply as possible. And my attitude was, I'm just going to go for everything we need in this law until we get stopped.
And the law was passed, and by all reports, it was a law that gave you what you wanted. And in fact, the results proved that, didn't they?
It was a good law. It did give us what we wanted. But the dynamics of it were very interesting. I mean, Rose Byrd was very moralistic, for example, about the boycott. And she was criticizing us about putting pressure on stores because at one point she characterized them as innocent parties. And our posture was, they're not innocent parties. They're part of an economic chain. They're making money off this scab fruit. And we had a position about the law which she didn't agree with. She ended up taking her marbles and going home in the middle of the night. Howard Berman came in with Reinhardt and Jerry Brown and I think Tom Dalzell and Tony Ginz were there. We cut the deal in the middle of the night.
Let's go on to seeing how the law works.
Yeah.
What were the results in the first 2 years?
The results were incredible. There were like 400 representation elections in the first 6 months of that law. And the Teamsters won some elections, but we won a lot more elections. It gave us a foothold. At first place, it gave us a legal right to be recognized. And as you know, this fight, by and large, was about recognition and dignity in the early years. And this is the best law relating to farm labor in the country. So we won a lot of elections. And to their credit, the Farm Labor Board cranked out the paperwork that gave us the certifications so that the law was passed when in May 28, 75, became effective in August. By the following January, we were negotiating with vegetable growers in Salinas, and we got contracts without striking or boycotting them as a result of winning elections.
But somehow, I guess it's asking too much of a law to actually solve problems because what you saw was 2 good years, and then the law was there, but elections weren't being won, contracts weren't being negotiated. Something changed.
Well, you see, the law created a dynamic that put a lot of pressure on the Teamsters Union. We had 2 big lawsuits, an antitrust suit and a civil rights suit, and then we had all these myriad administrative proceedings. And at some point, when the Teamsters looked at the bottom line, because that's what they were interested in, they were spending more money than they were getting in farm worker dues. So the law led directly to a Teamster jurisdictional pact, which we negotiated in 1977. After that, unfortunately, the union became a little inward-looking, started to do naval watching. Caesar sort of retreated into La Paz. Some people think maybe it's because of the lack of competition. That may be one element. But the other element is we were also having some internal discussions and internal problems.
But, I mean, you know, switching gears a little bit, Caesar was someone that functioned at his best when there was an enemy in a campaign. And once the Teamsters were gone and you could win elections, what was the fight? What were you fighting?
Well, there are a lot of unorganized growers out there. I don't buy the argument that there was no campaign to be fought. We had gotten, a certain percentage of vegetables. We'd gotten some grapes. There are a lot of grapes and a lot of vegetables left unorganized. And as a matter of fact, when you get really good wages from a few growers, it's probably wise to organize their competition so you don't create an unrealistic island and put people out of business. And some of the wages in the vegetables were very good. I don't think it was that there was no enemy. I think it was that Caesar was worried about the direction the union was taking. He didn't want to become, as he put it, like any other AFL union. He was worried about becoming another business trade union. And so he focused inwardly on how to keep the union, a fighting cause.
Well, was it also that he was worried about losing control, do you think?
That probably part of it. I think that, ironically, you see, one of the raps that I've heard about since Caesar died is that he couldn't delegate. I never found that to be the case. I mean, he delegated me the power to negotiate that law, said, just do the best you can. He let people loose. Now, in the late 70s, I think he had some, what I think are unwarranted suspicions of some really good organizers like Eliseo Medina and Marshall Gans, and I think that was unfortunate. And I think that sort of made the union a little bit constipated so that they didn't really do much after the late 70s.
Because their rationale was, well, once the administration changes, the law is stacked against us, that means we can't organize.
Well, the argument that the Duke Majan administration did in the law is nonsense. It's ironic that a law and order administration like Duke Majan's wouldn't enforce the law, but it's not surprising because Duke Majan was, after all, nurtured by agribusiness. And, you know, one constant in our political life is that politicians tend to cater to the special interests that nurture them. So you could expect Duke Majan to do that. What was surprising is that he got away with it. And it seems to me that it comes back to a basic principle, which is that unions that don't organize die. And so the union needed to organize because people in motion create pressure to get laws enforced. You have to remember that even when Brown was governor, we sat in the ALRB offices. We put a lot of pressure on him because he had appointed some people that were pretty laid back about enforcing that law. And you know, that law was like putting a saddle on a wild horse. It was like a bucking bronco. You really had to focus to enforce it. So ask an organizer like Marshall. He got arrested in the ALRB office. My first hearing in front of the full board, I asked for the resignation of Brown's general counsel because he wasn't enforcing the law. And how we got the law enforced was to have engaged farm workers who took responsibility for their own lives go and beat the hell out of those politicians. Because in our experience, at least my experience, was that Democrats weren't that different from Republicans. If you didn't pressure them, they didn't perform. So the idea that Duke Majan somehow stopped the union from organizing, I think, is laughable. I think nothing can stop people when they decide to get in motion.
Yeah, I mean, that's like saying Duke Majan was more powerful than the Teamsters Union, than all the growers.
Look, I guess a different way to look at it is, think about this. When we built the union, Reagan was governor and Nixon was president. You had the Teamsters out there on the field. You had Yahoo DAs in Kern County, in Monterey County. You had the sheriffs acted like the private army of the growers. That didn't stop the Farm Workers Union. So to say that a mediocre politician like Duke Majan could is just not true. I just don't believe it, never have, and never will. And I'm glad the union's starting to organize again, because that'll generate power.
Let's change here, and then we'll shift gears too. Duke Majan's really sort of...
Yeah. Okay, that's the end of camera roll 98, and that was take number 2. We're now going to camera roll 99, and take 3.
I mean, civil disobedience is civil disobedience.
Speed.
Rolling. Take 3. Marker.
Let's switch gears and talk about the Teamsters. They're a thread that sort of runs through the whole union's history. They started in DeGeorge. They came back in 73.
Right.
And you kept on fighting them. And
yes.
Each time you thought it was over, and it wasn't.
Yes.
I mean, you started in Pirelli. Did you think that was going to settle it?
The Teamsters... There's this continuing love story between the Teamsters and the growers, you know. And Pirelli Minetti was in 1967. They had signed a sweetheart contract with a winery, and we boycotted the winery, and we did get a contract. And one of the first big meetings I was ever at was at the Teamsters headquarters in Burlingame, Caesar and Dolores and I. And there was this big mahogany table, and it was like a different world. I'd never been in a room like that in my life. And to talk about recognition, this really sort of is instructive. Fred Pirelli Minetti would not talk directly to Caesar. He would talk to his attorney, a guy named Dick White, who would then talk to me, and then I'd talk to Caesar. That's how strained relations were. And the Teamsters, to their disgrace at that point, you know, acted like a handmaiden of the growers. They were used as a weapon. Now, we did get a pact with them, but it was a very short document with no adequate enforcement procedure. But I think that we thought we really didn't have enough power to do much more than that. So we didn't know if they'd come back. We hoped that they'd be gone. But of course, they then come back at the end of 1973 when the grape contracts expire. And they sign with the grape industry. And that is, as you may know, might have been engineered right from the White House, because Fitzsimmons was invited to the Farm Bureau and Colson may have been involved. And the growers didn't want elections. And so they basically stole those contracts. It is a continuing thread, but the pact that we finally got in 1977 after the pressure of the law had enforcement mechanisms in it, and the Teamsters did abide by that pact.
Rolling.
Okay, Jerry Cohen, take 4. Marker.
Another to talk a little bit about is the end of the grape boycott. The events in 1970.
But I want to say one more thing about the Teamsters, all right? You know, in 73, what I understand Grammy calls social workers, maybe that's a euphemism for goons, you know, those guys that were pounding us on the picket line. Our response to that at one point was to say of the Teamsters as they signed these sweetheart contracts, well, you know, once a whore, always a whore. And I got a call from a woman who saw the movie Fighting for Our Lives, in which that comment is made, and she was organizing prostitutes in Seattle, and she said, "Never compare my sisters to the Teamsters Union." So I just wanted you to know that.
Let's talk about 1970, about the final payoff for 5 years of the boycott
Yes.
and the strike, and what that first of all, what that felt like when it came to
Yeah. Hewitt. Well, you know, I was really lucky because I was one of the people negotiating those contracts. So in a way, I was the beneficiary of all the hard work that people like Mike Vasquez and Marcos Munoz and Jessica and Eliseo and everybody did. It started in Coachella. We got a contract with Lionel Steinberg, David Friedman. And we had a few other contracts that were a result of a little bit of boycott pressure, but basically they were growers who saw the handwriting on the wall. But the dynamic that kicked in was unbelievable, because here we had growers that were resisting even talking to us, and all of a sudden there was a premium, price premium for lugs of grapes that had the Union Eagle on it, and the little black bird. And it was like, as I told you earlier, the Maltese Falcon. Everybody wanted the black bird on their box. And the first time I sensed the power of the boycott was going into the Tenneco shed. It's a cold storage shed. I think it was in Thermal or Mecca. And they showed us the growers that had Union label, there were very few Union lugs. The growers without the Union label, those lugs were stacked to the wall. And it felt so great to know that the boycott had started to kick in. So we started getting contracts in Coachella.
Well, let's look at the other side of it. What do you think those Delano growers felt, these guys who... It was like an act of faith that they would never talk to you. What do you think that was doing to them?
This bird is really loud.
Well, let's throw something at it.
Stop.
We should cut. Yes. Cut. Sally bird.
Rolling.
Hey, Jerry Cohen. This is take five.
So,
Marker.
I know you're talking about people who you don't experience their world, but. Try and give me some insight into what these Delano growers were like that made them so intractable.
Well, part of it had to do, I think, with race. Part of it, I think, had to do with the fact that we were messing with their land. And part of it had to do with the fact that you had self-made, self-reliant people who built things on their own. And they were damned if anybody, no matter what race, is going to tell them how to run their lives. And I have a grudging respect for a lot of those growers. A lot more respect than you have, like, for their minions, the sheriffs and the DAs. And I think that they just didn't want to be told what to do on their own land. I mean, it was like that scene with Fred Pirelli Minetti when we settled with the Teamsters in 1967. He really couldn't even look Caesar in the eye and talk to him. He had to transmit his words to his attorney, to me, and then to Caesar. It was about basic recognition and dignity, and they didn't want to give it to their workers. For some motives that I think we can understand, and some motives I think that are pretty reprehensible.
So when you finally get a call from John Giamara, you know that you've really backed these people to the wall.
Well, I think one of the most exciting nights of my life was when Johnny Giamara Jr. called me. It was a Saturday night in July. As a matter of fact, it's July 25th, 1970, and he was calling from his 10th high school reunion. And that's kind of interesting because Marshall Gans, one of our best organizers, was also in that class. And he called and he basically said, my father and I are going to go on a trip and we're going to beat the hell out of the Union and we'd like to meet. And our posture, you know, was always to play it tough. And I said, well, you know, go on your trip and then we'll meet. Good luck. And he said, no, Jerry, we want to meet tonight. And then I realized that something important was going on, that this was the biggest grape grower in the state, 12,000 acres of grapes. And they wanted to meet, and I was really excited. I didn't want Johnny Jr. knowing it. And they wanted to meet that night. He called about 9, he called back about 10. Caesar was on the road. I left a message for Caesar, and we met in room 44 of the Stardust Motel. John Giamara Jr. and John Sr. And basically, the position that Caesar and I took at that meeting was that we wanted them to round up all the Delano growers. And frankly, we were a little uneasy about that position. That bird is celebrating the settlement of the strike. We were uneasy about that position because we really didn't know if we had enough power to get these guys. This was the nut of the industry, the hardest people to crack. And when they agreed to round those people up the next morning, it was a hell of a feeling. It was like the culmination of all those years of work that the people had put in on the boycott. So it was exciting. As a matter of fact, when Caesar died, my first thought was to get a room at the Stardust Motel and go back to the place where those contracts started, that negotiation started for those contracts.
Now, one of the conditions when you signed the contract was that they had to come to 40 acres to sign.
Yes, it was.
Say that again. Tell us.
When the growers, we told Giamara first that we had a few conditions. First, we wanted them to round up all of the Delano growers. They said they could do it. So the next day, at I think the St. Mary's School, there they all were. All these people we'd never even seen before. They were just names. You know, it was like the myth of Radovich or Pavich or Karatan. Jack Pandel, of course, we'd seen because he was a pretty vocal guy. And when we were spinning out the discussions, we told them that we wanted them to come to the 40 acres and sign the contract. And to their credit, some of them decided, well, if they're going to have to sign these contracts, they might as well be in a cooperative, celebratory mood about it. And so they came to the 40 acres, and that was, I think, on Wednesday, maybe the 29th of, it was Wednesday the 29th when they signed. But, you know, we didn't have any time to enjoy that celebration.
But do you remember what that felt like, getting them to sit down at the table there at 40 acres?
Well, they didn't sit at it. They came to sign at the 40 acres. The feeling for me was when the call came from Johnny Jr., because then there was a lot of work to be done. Then you had to do the drafting of the language. Then I was into, like, the technicalities of helping put the contract together. So the excitement I had was that Saturday night. Seeing them all there, in a way, was sort of anticlimactic, because we already had heard that the Teamsters were negotiating a sweetheart deal in Salinas. So it was like a boa constrictor that swallowed a big pig or something. We didn't even have time to digest the meal. We were off to Salinas. No, my excitement was the night Johnny Jr. called. I mean, it was wonderful seeing the growers at the 40 acres, but we knew we had another fight looming immediately on the horizon.
Well, was there ever a moment during those years when you thought you were out of the woods? Or was it always?
You know, I guess maybe it's because you don't learn that quickly about how entrenched some economic interests are. I thought we'd won. I thought, now we got the grapes. They've signed sweetheart contracts in the vegetables, and then we'll go on to the citrus. I was kind of maybe naive enough to think that we were just going to be able to knock these guys off. That's the sense of power that you had. It was wrong, because these fights have to be fought over and over again. But those are lessons that you sort of learn as you get kicked around a little bit.
And cut for a second. Let's stop. How much do we have left on this?
Okay, that's take five.
30.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 99 and the end of the sound roll.
Change those. Sometimes you change those.
Okay, now we're starting camera roll 100. Our next take will be take six. We're continuing the interview with Jerry Cohen. Take six is next. Speed.
Okay, this is Jerry Cohen, take six. Marker.
We're talking about getting kicked around. And that brings us to Salinas in 1970.
Yes.
Give me a little background of what it was like when the strike started in Salinas. What was the level of energy, and what were people thinking about?
Well, as you know, the Teamsters signed a sweetheart contract that gave the workers exactly 0.5 cent increase a year for 5 years. That organized the workers. We didn't even know where the ranches were. We came up here, and people would come in from ranches and say, we're from Man Packing. And we'd say, where's Man Packing? We're from Hanson. We're from Merrill. I mean, workers were pouring in from the valley. And so we could thank the Teamsters for what was a huge agricultural strike. The flags were from San Ardo down in South Monterey County all the way up through Gilroy. It looked like a revolution, and some of these right-wing growers thought it was. You know, they had bumper stickers that said, Reds, let us alone. It was an amazing outpouring of energy. And, you know, we had a lot of obstacles to fight because the Teamsters had signed these sweetheart contracts, and the local judiciary was fairly prejudiced and not very good, and injunctions were issued that prevented us from striking. Later, we got them overturned in the California Supreme Court because they found that the growers had, quote, felt out the Teamsters. You know, sexual metaphors and imagery for what, in fact, was a love affair.
But I mean, this had really been brewing for a while because the people in Salinas had been waiting for their chance after the great contract was signed. Right?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But, you know, the union was thinking seriously about the citrus at that point. There had been a few people talking to vegetable workers, but we also were in a frame of mind of trying to get contracts where there was work year-round. And we thought citrus would be another good place like grapes where you have a lot of work throughout the year. Vegetables come and go. You know, there's a couple of seasons. There's little winter in August. There's some picking that goes on in the fall. But you're dealing with a migratory, moving group of workers. So it wasn't by any means clear, Rick, that that's where we were going. And I think that the vegetable growers brought the union upon themselves by doing that. But the outburst, your question was really about the outburst of energy. It was unbelievable because it was an education to us of these workers. And I think there's a difference between the psychology of the vegetable workers and the grape workers. And I think it has to do with the fact that these vegetable workers were working on a highly perishable crop. They'd had a history of wildcat strikes. They worked in trios more closely. They divided the money among the crew, and they were very tough. And they knew exactly what they wanted, and what they wanted was their own union.
Now, the response was pretty strong and pretty violent, and you were caught up in that response yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. We had an injunction that prevented us from striking, and so we devised a strategy. We decided, well, if they fire the workers, then it's not a strike, and then we'll just keep other workers out. And the workers in Hanson, in the broccoli, decided they wanted to participate in this, and what they wanted to do was sit on their broccoli plants until they were dismissed. And then, in effect, we'd have a strike, even though the judge said we couldn't. So we knew that there were some Teamster goons in town, and we told the workers, you can go in and sit on those broccoli plants, but come on out by 9:30. And when they weren't out, we got worried. And so I walked into the Hanson field with Jacques Levy and with the editor of El Macriado, Venustiano Olguin, and his wife. And we were surrounded by some pickups and a bunch of big guys. But I was feeling pretty cocky. I didn't think they were going to touch anybody. And Hanson confronted us and said, this is our property, Hanson's property. Get off the property. And we said, well, we'll leave when we know that the workers are safe. So when they've left, we'll leave. And at that point, he said to this guy, Jimmy Plemons, who is a very big guy, get him, boys. And all Plemons did at that point was sort of pick me up by my jacket and lift me up. Now, I weighed about 200 pounds at that point, so Plemons was a pretty big boy. So he picked me up and was dangling me, and I think their intent was simply to...
We got a plane problem. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll do that.
All right.
Okay, that was take six. Take seven's next.
This is take seven, Jerry Cohen, marker.
So you went into Hanson's and...
And Hanson said, this is our land and you're trespassing. And my response was, we want to know that the workers that are on your land are safe, and so when they leave, we'll leave. And at that point, Hanson said, get them, boys. And a big guy named Jimmy Plemons, about 6'5", and I think he was over 300, picked me up by my jacket. And I think his intent was simply to just remove us from the property. But I, at that point, yelled to Jacques Levy, having probably too big a mouth, I yelled, hey Jacques, take a picture of this. And when I yelled that, the next thing I saw was a big fisted glove in the air, turned out to be owned by a man named Bobby Scheisler. He hit me on the jaw. I saw Levy's camera sort of being drop kicked through the air. It looked like it was in slow motion. I saw Levy go down, and then I went down and out. And then the damnedest thing is, you know, we were, I think, kind of bloodied up. I don't think we looked all that great. We went down this dirt road to the edge of the field, and there was a Monterey County sheriff's deputy there. And he saw what condition we were in, but there was an injunction at that field, and he leaned over and he said, hey, Cohen, you got too many pickets at this entrance. And that sort of shows you what the law enforcement around here was like at that point in 1970. I ended up in the hospital with a concussion for a week, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, that happened to you, but things like that happened to many people.
See, that was relatively minor. I mean, it got some play because I was the union's lawyer, and the Teamsters ran around saying, hey, we killed your lawyer, and that made people kind of mad. But some people were pounded, there was a lot of rough stuff. And they wanted to intimidate the workers, but I think they underestimated the fiber of a lot of these guys in the lettuce, in the vegetables in general, because they didn't intimidate anybody.
Let's go back again to later on to 79.
Yeah.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I really think it's hard, and you've got to work to make us understand what happened to the Union after 79.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just some weird stuff in the air and Caesar didn't flip out, but something happened. And
yeah.
What do you think it was?
Well, you know, the Union had a wonderful period of organizing, and I think we shouldn't downplay all its accomplishments. But the Union then went through a downtime where it lost its way for a while. And my attitude about that is maybe a little different than some. I don't think we should point fingers at any one person. I think all of us shared in the good things that the Union did, and I think we're all to blame for some of the problems. And I think the problems are complicated. And I think one issue was the question of voluntarism. There was the question of whether you could have, when you had a contract, a volunteer who would, there would be a big turnover, administer those contracts, or whether you needed to have some minimal pay. The legal department was getting paid a minimal amount. So there was the issue of voluntarism, and some of the workers wanted to have salaries. That was one issue. The other issue was the issue of community. Caesar wanted the Union to be up at La Paz. And so there was a discussion. And to me, it was like an internal political discussion. And you know, when you engage in an internal political fight, and you're fighting with somebody that's as wily and smart and determined as Caesar, if you don't win the fight, well, you're going to lose the fight. And Caesar's a strong guy. And I think that some of us had disagreements with him about those issues. And I think that tended to cause Caesar to become overly suspicious of a few very good people. And the people that jumped to my mind that were the two of the most talented organizers were Eliseo Medina, who left in 1978, and Marshall Gantz. And I think those folks were really talented. And I don't think that the tension that developed between Caesar and Marshall could have been avoided, but I think it was all of us that helped participate in not getting those communications going. So the irony to me is that here we were, we could negotiate with Teamsters and get them out of the fields. We could negotiate with growers. We could negotiate with a sly politician like Jerry Brown and get a farm labor law. But sadly, we couldn't negotiate among ourselves and settle these internal problems. Then Caesar became, I think, overly suspicious of a few people. I mean, I know I left in the early 80s, and I thought once I left on fairly good terms. But after I had left, Marshall got attacked, and I came to his defense, and then we were in the soup because some local Salinas workers wanted to run for the executive board, which I think they had the right to do, and Caesar thought Marshall put them up to it, which he didn't. They had minds of their own. And he blamed Marshall for that. And it seems to me that, you know, it's unfortunate it happened. It caused the Union to lose a few years. And what I'm hoping is that they'll get back to the basics and organize.
I mean, and during that period, even though the Union had been red-baited externally, that was used internally. Some people were subversive and they had to leave because...
There were charges. I never took any of that very seriously. I always thought that everybody knew better. I mean, Caesar was worried about people trying to subvert the Union, and I thought the Union was strong enough nobody could subvert the Union. And I think the real issue was the question of the distribution of political power. Like I say, there's a little ambivalence and dichotomy here because in my relationship with Caesar over the years, he was very good. He would delegate a lot of authority and power and not worry.
But is it possible that you had a special relationship with him?
I wasn't an organizer. I was an English-speaking lawyer whose job it was to be a voice for farm workers in the courts, with the growers, with the politicians. So you're right. I was not the kind of political threat to Caesar that an organizer might be. But realistically, Caesar had so much talent as an organizer, none of those organizers could have ever really challenged him. So I never really understood his overreaction.
Nor did they want to.
My take on this, and you're going to get a disagreement from people in the Union, but I believe that Marshall and Eliseo wanted to do what the rest of us wanted to do, namely build a farm workers union.
I mean, it's sort of interesting, you know, the classic phrase about Cuba that Fidel
okay,
said
that was take
inside the revolution,
seven
everything,
and
outside nothing. You know,
yeah.
It's the end of camera roll 100. We're now going to camera roll 101, and yes. Our next take will be take 8.
We should have another.
Speed. Rolling.
This is take 9, marker.
But Jerry, we were just finishing up with 79. when this stuff played out to the outside world, people who weren't in La Paz, you know, one of the things that really sort of summed up how far the union had strayed from its course was the issue of getting involved with Synanon and therapy sessions and those things. And the issue, you know, so an organizer said, well, how would we explain this to people in the fields?
Right. See, there were two different worlds. I think the lettuce cutters that I knew here were baffled, first by the existence of La Paz, and second when they heard of something called the Synanon game. And as I say, there may have been reasons that Caesar wanted to do it, to try to build a community of true believers, whatever, but it seems to me the focus of any union, if a union's going to survive, is organizing. And you have to organize in the fields, and you have to respond to the needs of the people in the fields. And that's what the union was so great at for all those years. And that, I think, is the lifeblood of any union, because unions that don't organize die. So when the union strayed from its path and began to look inward and stopped organizing, I think that then created the conditions for what you saw in the 80s, which is a relative lack of action.
And in the 80s, boycotting went on, but the boycotting wasn't rooted in a strike. It didn't have farm worker families traveling as they had in the original boycott.
See, a boycott to really work has to be rooted in the reality of the struggle. And the reason the boycott won in 1970 is because farm workers went all over the country and told people the story of their own lives. And it seems to me that in the 80s, Caesar was spending his own image like coin out on a boycott. And a boycott may have been a necessary response to what was happening, but it was not a sufficient response. To really work, a boycott has to be integrated in a struggle that starts in the fields.
Now, let's go back to the fields themselves. You said that, you know, the high point of one of the things you did was when you got the call from Jamara. Tell me a little bit about what Jamara represented. What was it like for people who worked for Jamara? What was his operation like?
Jamara had the biggest table grape operation in the industry. It was 12,000 acres. Jamara had workers living in a camp right there at the Edison headquarters. Getting into that camp was a major operation. I mean, we tested it. Marcos Munoz went in there, and I went in there one night to try to get arrested, but they were too smart to arrest us. But it was really tough for workers who sort of lived behind the lines. Jamara's wages were not that good. None of the wages in the grapes were that good. But the fight really was even more basic than that. Workers wanted to be represented, and they wanted a voice in their own working conditions, and Jamara led the fight to refuse to recognize or even deal with the workers at that level. So it's a basic fight about dignity. You have secondary issues of needing cool, potable drinking water and adequate toilets for men and women, and that always flowed and could be dealt with in a contract. But first, you had to win recognition. And John Jamara Sr., by the way, he's a guy I admire because he's a feisty, fighting man who built his own empire. He was going to be damned if anybody was going to tell him how to run it. And that was the issue with Jamara. So we struck Jamara, and the strike, like most strikes, was effective for a while, but then a lot of poor people came from across the border. And then we started boycotting Jamara. And, you know, we sort of stumbled into the grape boycott. I mean, if people want to go back and figure out the history of this, we started boycotting the Jamara label, which is the Ara label. And the Delano growers came to their brother's aid by trading labels with Jamara. And our only response was, well, if all your labels are going to be down there, what the hell? We'll boycott all table grapes. And so that's how that sort of came about. It wasn't anything that we sat down and ingeniously figured out. It sort of was a response to the growers' action of loaning Jamara their labels.
Talk to me a little bit about how you saw what you did in the legal field and how that connected with striking and organizing and boycotting. How was that all part?
Well, we sort of practiced legal karate. I mean, we were trying to put, you know, some set of rights in an area where there wasn't a set of rights. It was the law of the jungle. There was no law protecting farm workers. When the National Labor Relations Act was passed, the Wagner Act of 1935, agricultural laborers and domestics were excluded. So we had to sort of create causes of action. But the simple answer to your question is, we decided that we had the law as a weapon, that we needed to use boycotting, striking, and we needed to use the pressure of the law. We needed to use the law to raise the issue of pesticides. And then we weren't afraid to trade a lawsuit for a clause in a contract that protected workers in terms of pesticides. So the law, when it was working well, was just one more weapon that we used, to say nothing of the fact that we needed to use the First Amendment to protect our rights to speak. You know, when we struck, they would take our bullhorns away, so I'd have to go to the appellate courts and get our bullhorns back. So there was that element of it. Protecting the voice of the farm workers is basically what I think we were trying to do with the use of the law.
Because as the law went into effect, I'm talking about the ALRA,
yeah.
There was a sense that as the growers became more sophisticated in using the law, that in fact the struggle for enforcing it had moved exclusively into the legal side.
See, I think that that's one of the things that sort of threw the union off track for a little bit, although I don't think it's insurmountable. We had very sophisticated lawsuits that we filed against the Teamsters, antitrust suits and civil rights suits, which helped create pressure that we used to negotiate the Teamsters out of the field. But we also had the strictures of the Agricultural Labor Relations Act. You know, you had to file objections to elections within 5 days. A lot of paperwork had to be processed. But I don't think any of that was insurmountable. It just was just one more task that had to be performed. But if you're organizing and you're fighting, I think you accept that burden.
No, but I mean, the sense was, well, if the growers can afford more lawyers who can file more pieces of paper, they can stop us in the courts and the law won't be enforced.
See, I never bought that argument because when the legal department was still in place, that, in fact, didn't happen. We won the certifications. We won the hearings where we should have won, and those that we lost, we probably should have lost. And I think the law was working fairly well. And I think we had the setup. You didn't need to be a lawyer to practice in front of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board. A paralegal could do that. And we were training a lot of people. You know, at one point we had, maybe over 20 lawyers and 44 paralegals in the legal department. But I don't think the task was insurmountable because during the period of most intense activity, when there were 400 elections, we were able to handle it. So the argument that the law somehow drained energy from the union, it's specious because, you see, a fight attracts real talent. We had very good organizers and very good lawyers, and there were a ton of labor lawyers around this state who, frankly, were bored with their own clients because they weren't very aggressive, who were giving us help and handling cases for us. So we were able to handle that workload.
But I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what it sounds like what you're saying is that losing an effective legal department was what really created the problem.
I think that the problem is more complicated than that. It's always bad to blow your own horn, but, you know, I think we had a good legal department. And I think when you lose good lawyers, you take a blow. I told Caesar if he wanted a volunteer legal department, we had to have a long transition so that the turtle could grow a new shell. And I don't think Caesar let enough time go by so that the turtle could grow a new shell. Now, I think the people that are working there are doing the best they can, but I think it's also a function of the fact that once Artie commits to organizing, or once any union starts organizing, the necessary talent is going to be attracted to the fight.
That'll be the starter.
Yeah, but I also believe that it's easier to replace lawyers than it is good organizers. And I think the fact that the union lost some very good organizers in the late 70s and early 80s was a much bigger blow to the union than the loss of any kind of professional staff.
So here we are in 1995, 30 years later. What has changed since the struggle started? Where are we today?
Well, you know what? In Salinas, there are labor contractors everywhere. A few years ago, there were some poor young kids from Salvador living in caves on the side of a hill picking berries. They had parasites in their intestines. They were drinking water out of pesticide cans. There are workers living in canyons outside of San Diego now. So I'm afraid that from one point of view, not a lot has changed. From another point of view, there is the best farm labor law in the books in California. The union still has a pulse, no matter what people say. It's one of the few institutions that have survived from the 60s. It has the capability of organizing. People know how to win that fight because they've won it already. So I think what's changed is a lot of people went to school, basically, with the UFW for those years, and they learned a lot of lessons that are good to learn. And I think there's the talent there to do it, and the law's there to do it, and I hope the will is there to do it.
But does that mean that you start over again, or is there something to build on?
I think there is something to build on in terms of the fact that there's an institutional memory. There is still in the Union, there are people like Dolores, who has a lot of guts. Artie grew up in the years of those struggles. He's the president of the Union. They know how to organize and they know how to fight. So the nucleus of a winning team is there. They just have to go out and build that team.
Would you go back one more time to tell me the story about going back to Delano after you heard Caesar died?
Yeah.
How did you hear the news?
I got a call from a guy in Washington who was working with the Washington farm workers just on my machine, and he said, I think Caesar died. And then I got a call from the press, which was kind of cold because, I mean, this is a good friend of mine and a guy I lived, you know, worked with for 14 years. And my first thought was, you know, it's hard to even talk about it now. My first thought was to go back to that hotel where we signed those grape contracts. I can't talk about it, Rick. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
It's kind of painful, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of take one, camera 101 and take eight.
It did. No, it was cold. I got these calls.
Okay, that's the end of the sound roll, too. Goodbye.